And she, hey, White Sox fans, guess what? It is podcast number 3 of the Believe in White Sox podcast. And believe it or not, you're probably not going to believe it, but believe it or not, this is the hottest and fastest growing White Sox podcast out there. Take my word for it. I would not lie to you. With me again, probably the guy pulling in all the big numbers, but leading clearly to the big spike in listenership we have on Believe in White Sox, the podcast. It's my partner, Tommy Barbie. Thank you for joining me again, Tommy.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be on.
The good news, in addition to our burgeoning listenership, Tommy, is the White Sox are, they're good. And based on the fact that the four teams in the division they're competing with aren't very good, they can almost, at this point, it seems like almost back or sidestep their way into a stranglehold on the division. We had a little pause yesterday with the sort of sneak rain out. We're beginning these, as we're recording tonight here, beginning a series against the Detroit Tigers, another of the really, really difficult competition the White Sox face on a routine basis in the AL Central.
Yep.
So we had a chance to pause a little bit and think about where we're at in the season, passing the one-third mark. Give me your general thoughts about where the Sox stand and how the rest of the season looks like to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to feel good about the White Sox and their chances right now. I mean, they, even with the injuries that they've sustained so far this year, they really haven't had a huge challenge dealing with even some of the better teams in the league. Yes, skeptics will look at how they performed against Angels, Yankees, and even the most recent series against the Cleveland isn't ideal, but those to me were kind of really good benchmarks where you're looking at a White Sox team that wasn't really firing on all cylinders and still made it really hard on all of those teams in each of the series. And even the Yankees series, I don't think they ever looked overmatched.
Let's take a snapshot of where the White Sox are. This is probably right to the moment, including some day game results. But the White Sox right now, 33-22 as we are recording. They are 2.5 games up in first place. They have a magic number of 106, Tommy. Magic number.
Very nice.
The run differential has consistently now been second behind an NL West team. It was the Padres. After the Padres decided to completely blow a series against the Northsiders, the top run differential team in baseball is the Dodgers now.
Dodgers.
So right behind them. Their projected record based on the run differential, 106 wins. And what I think is interesting about the 106 wins, which they're not going to get, and I'll tell you why in a second, is the fact that no other AL Central team has a positive run differential. So if we're just looking at run differential, which, okay, big deal, run differential, but let's just use that as a thumbnail. The rest of the division's under 500, and the White Sox are going to be winning the division by 27 games projected. Now, the reason why they're not going to win 106 games and they're not going to win by that, among many reasons, is the fact that the White Sox – have 33 wins and the run differential will project them at 36. Again, you could look at a lot of factors there. Luck. You could look at the skill of the manager. There are a lot of weird between the lines factors there, but the truth is the White Sox are underperforming in spite of the fact that they are overcoming a lot of injuries, as you already pointed out. They are underperforming what they should be doing to a pretty significant degree already. So chances of them somehow waking up and getting and fulfilling that full run differential record is unlikely, but it's still very promising when you look at the fact that nobody else in the AL Central is really, there's nobody getting cheated. They're not getting cheated out of any wins in the Central.
Yeah. And I mean, it is interesting thinking about it that way because, you know, the mantra has been, oh, look at the White Sox record, look at the White Sox record. And, you know, I thought it's been kind of interesting that people have started comparing the current record to where the White Sox were last year. And the record was actually better for the team last year, even though they didn't have a lot of the pieces that they had to work with this year. You know, there are many, many theories that one can have on the reasons why that is, but it's true that this team is still somewhat underperforming, as weird as it is to say, based on where they could be as a roster.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to talk about the fact that the White Sox have done what they've done, seemingly lacking depth. We find that out on a daily basis.
Yes.
Given the fact that just today, Gavin Sheets is called up, presumably if he's going to play at all, and he may not, to fill in the outfield, probably not at first base, potentially a little bit of time at first base. Yet another guy who's not even an outfielder who's being, you know, tapped in for depth. Now you could say, oh my God, who could have figured that the White Sox were going to have like 16 injured outfielders this year? Well, I mean, the job of management is to anticipate, maybe not to that absurd a degree, but to anticipate, hey, maybe we should have a couple real players just that we can tap into who's not like Brian Goodwin.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, bless him, even Billy Hamilton or Adam Eaton as a guy that you're expecting to come right in and bat second a lot of days right in your lineup. So it's great to sort of look at it like, okay, look where they're coming from. Look at the fact they didn't have their two key players virtually all year, and they may not have them basically for the entire season. And that's great if we're playing some, you know, weird like card game or some, you know, game where we're just looking at numbers on a piece of paper. That's great to say, wow, they really had an incredible year given all the setbacks. But you know, the truth is, we're seeing it with Cleveland. Where they're getting some key injuries, some flood of key injuries. Now, maybe they don't line up with Eloy Jimenez or Luis Robert. Maybe they don't. Maybe they do. But I mean,
it still adds up.
Got to figure over the course of the season, everything's going to pretty much even out. The White Sox aren't suddenly going to become the infirmary of the American League, and everybody else is going to be like, sorry, suckers. You know, we're all healthy and we're going to beat you now. You know, it's going to even out. So we can't even use that as too much of a crutch. I'm sure Cleveland would like to have all their guys back, even if it meant maybe our couple guys in the outfield came back.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's also, for one, I'm not entirely surprised that Gavin Sheets got called up just because of how well he was hitting. Mm-hmm. But to me, Blake Rutherford was right there. Mm-hmm. And long-term, that's the guy that I would think the White Sox would want to take a look at to help with the outfield depth and kind of have that answer in the back of their mind sooner rather than later. And it just seemed a little strange to me for that reason. Now, if, you know, to your point, Sheets may not even play, so it may not matter, but it was just kind of an interesting choice to me for that reason.
Yeah, but it's a nice reward too for a guy who has really, it's pretty interesting, I guess. Maybe there's some dispute about whether he was in Schaumburg. I thought from the start he was not in the alternate site at all last year, I thought that was part of the extra chip that he was not there. We didn't hear anything about him. I will say that much.
True. That's true. Yeah.
And you know, either way, the fact that it's like, okay, dude, Andrew Vaughn's passed you. You know, we're thinking of bringing him up this year. You may not even be in Schaumburg. I guess we're not really certain. But the fact that, you know, he learned a position,
brand new position. Yes.
Was a thing.
It's a theme for the White Sox this year.
Hey, any of you, and I know it's an increasing number of White Sox minor leaguers who are listening to the Believe in White Sox podcast, because just numbers are going through the roof, Tommy. So all of you minor leaguers, I don't think I have to tell you, but I mean, I think what you're going to want to do in the offseason, not to look ahead to that yet, you got to just pick up a new position. You know, if you're third baseman, you might want to pitch. If you're a catcher, maybe center field, because that does seem like the way the White Sox are going.
Yeah. And I mean, I really huge kudos to him for not only learning the position, but becoming adequate as a corner outfielder. Like, that's really impressive. That, you know, usually guys that you hear about that are first baseman types that are usually on the bulkier end, like there is a cement block that can catch the ball if it's within a 5-foot radius of them, but otherwise they don't do anything. And he's actually done a very good job out there.
I hate to pick on him, but he's, but you expect him to be like an Eloy Jimenez.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Eloy. I'm sorry. But you fall in the net and then you act like you're sort of playing, which I get it. It's sort of like cute, but at a certain point, you just kind of not do that. Because people are, you know, they're just dying to type in. They're dying to plug you into like the meme generator and just type in some funny words when you're in the net like this. You just, you can't do anymore, Loy, if they even let you out there again. But yeah, Gavin has actually played a pretty clean. He's played full games, so it's not even doing like spot stuff. He's not getting subbed out late for
exactly.
D. He sort of had a, I guess, sort of a somewhat lame game in left field, but he only played there once because I think Blake Rutherford is your left fielder. And the fact that Blake has done so well, you name dropped him well, because I think probably for a real significant need, if this was maybe, I don't know, an Adam Eaton injury, not that he hasn't been banged up all year, but a guy, maybe a Billy Hamilton injury, where you really are going to need to have a guy out there and probably plug him in as soon as tonight, it might've been Blake Rutherford because he's done what they've asked. He's sort of trying to live up to the hype that Chris Getz has been laying on him for a couple of years now. And maybe he's not, doesn't have necessarily the home run power that everybody really wants to see from him, but he has proven that he's got, between his speed and some gap power, you know, slugging percentage is, you know, it's enough. This is a guy who probably did not merit AAA even quite yet, but because he lost the season, everybody just sort of automatically got, everybody matriculated at one grade this season. And some guys are flourishing there, surprisingly. And some guys are, you know, maybe still treading water, taking a step back.
Exactly. Yeah.
One guy, as we were looking over sort of the leaderboards here yesterday during the day off and sort of just assessing, you know, there's a lot of guys where you'd expect, you know, that Lance Lynn and Carlos Rodon are going to be on a lot of the pitching leaderboards. Guys like Abreu leading baseball and runs batted in. But the name that consistently came up on the offensive end, and he's just a guy that I think his nature is people just sleep on him. He's a guy I always consider really the MVP of the team, particularly when he's right. And that's Yoan Moncada. He is on, he's all over the place on the leaderboards, including just his sheer war. It's not even all offense. He's adding some positive defensive war as well. And it's so heartening to see him flourishing after a year that made us think, oh, geez, you know, what's the effect? And maybe even do you wonder, you know, is a sophomore or junior slump even?
Right.
He had one really strong year, then got sick and had a year that wasn't as bad as people think, but still enough to make you worry because he's still such a young guy. You don't know if his trajectory is five war all-star every season or not. And boy, it seems like he is quieting any of those concerns.
Yeah, I mean, you know, honestly, Yoan Moncada is my favorite player to watch on the White Sox, like by a long shot. I love Tim Anderson's swagger, but when Yoan Moncada is right, like the swing is as pretty as anything I've seen since Griffey. Like, I mean, it's just, he's the entire package. And you're right, he is so unassuming about his play because it doesn't necessarily show up in these gaudy offensive numbers. It's sometimes what he does on defense or what he does on the base paths. And it's just, he is such a complete, well-rounded player that I do think in a lot of ways, one of the reasons why the White Sox have been doing so well this year has been because of Moncada.
And he's probably the least likely in this lineup, least likely pop star, least likely flashy pop star.
I know.
Yep. I like seeing that side of him. It's super goofy, but how can you not love it? That it's like, okay, he's going to sucker punch you with that. That's
exactly
funny. That's pretty funny. Tommy, we were talking a little bit beforehand about the sorts of things that may concern you in the, let's say, latter two-thirds of the season.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's a flip of that to say, what are some things that maybe are laying low that should sort of regress to a mean in a real positive way? James Fox on Southside Sox, where we both write, this is sort of our companion site to this burgeoning and super hot taking over the baseball world Believe in White Sox podcast. It's sort of hand in hand. And on our site, James had written about Yasmani Grandal talking about how a lot of his numbers are going to, you know, so-called regress positively to a mean because he's not showing the power he should, et cetera. And that might be an answer right there. Guys like that sort of under hitting, but yet still, you know, playing well enough to be in the lineup. But is there something that you're sort of thinking about or looking at that might be a little surprise under the tree that, you know, maybe we can't count on 100% or we've even forgotten is there because, you know, we're just sort of dealing with the day-to-day of the season right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two areas that I would say are definitely Osmani Grandal and, you know, really that Southside article piece touches on so much of it. You even, and it's surprising to me, the people that argue about him taking walks, because it's just like, if you're walking at that rate, you're clearly seeing the ball in a way that nobody should ever be able to see the baseball. Yeah. And if you can see the ball that well, you're good. I'm not worried about you. The hits are going to come. Like, I know, I think part of it is, of course, the defensive shift that he's facing. Yeah. But I do think that there is some positive regression coming his way. The other I would say is I don't think the bullpen is going to be as rocky as they have been recently. And there've been some positive examples coming from, you know, guys like Foster, Marshall, that have kind of developed reputations of being not even necessarily lights out, but just solid relievers and not having that level of performance this year. I think they're starting to come around too. And to me, the only thing that I kind of question is how adept Rick Hahn will be to kind of solidify this roster. And that's why, for me, I start looking at the minor leagues prospects, because I want to see not only how do they fit in with this open window of the White Sox roster as it stands, but how are they going to hype these guys up if they don't have any intention of keeping them, but they want to package them for something else that makes sense. So, you know, are they going to start showing Blake Rutherford highlights on every White Sox Twitter feed when they have the opportunity to get as much helium in him because they don't believe in his bat long-term and they want to use him as a piece for something else?
Yeah, this is one thing we do not know whether Rick Hahn can do. We don't know he's going to do it.
Exactly.
We don't know if he does it well. He's never been in this position. You could argue that last year he was in the position, but that's, you know, listen, last year was a fake year. But okay, let's say that's been his one test so far. And that didn't go
too well. He didn't want to do it.
He sort of punted. Yeah. And it's great that he had the big team meeting where he tapped in everyone and Ricky and everybody spoke. And, you know, I don't know if the speculation was because they were sort of, the nature of that talk was like, were they talking about maybe like dealing for Mike Clevenger or somebody who's maybe a little more controversial, because you got that feeling of this person might not fit in the clubhouse. So let's talk to the team and see what they think. Obviously nothing materialized. And it didn't sound like the players were like, no, we don't want Yasiel Puig, or we don't want Mike Clevenger on the team. So that wasn't his excuse for not doing it, because it did seem like that meeting went like, hey, you know, we feel strong in this clubhouse. So he punted. Again, on sort of a fake year. And at the time, if I recall, I can't exactly remember, but the Sox were riding, I want to say they were riding pretty high. It wasn't in a panic mode and they weren't in a slow mode. So they were in a position of strength, and maybe the same thing's going to happen this year. If they got a 5-7 game lead, he might be like, I don't need anything.
I mean, that's why to me it's worth mentioning, because, you know, last year they were in a good spot, but I mean, they clearly needed starting pitching like just badly. And you know, I've said it on Twitter, I don't think I've ever said it officially, it would never shock me if 20 years from now, like, it comes out that you know, Ricky was trolling the White Sox brass by like throwing Rodon out there in relief appearances and all the weird shit that he was doing just to be like, hey, I don't have a starter. This is what I have to do. Here you go. Because I mean, that was such an obvious need. And this year, you feel good about a lot of things, but, you know, you're still relying on everything to work out perfectly in over a 162-game season, especially, like, not a shortened season like last year. Things will never work out perfectly. And, you know, you have to kind of go into it with worst case scenario, what is the roster that we have to move forward with? And that may mean another bat to help spell your mean Mercedes in case you think that was a short-lived thing. That may mean another relief pitcher that's a veteran that can help offset some of the youth that they have to make sure that they have someone else that can back up Hendricks so he's not burning out. Just little things here and there that I don't know where Han or the rest of the organization is, because like you said, they've never been here before.
It's terrifying, and I hate to always feel like doing podcasts, you know, you sort of dwell on the concerns and the negative. That's the nature of this too. The team's in first place. If they were in fourth place and they put together three out of four, if they were Detroit just having a good series against the Yankees, you'd be like, man, I think they're turning it around. This is great. So, I mean, this is the nature of it. But when you think about the fact, I mean, you didn't even really mention starting pitching as being a need, but anything happens to these guys.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a free fall because, okay, Dallas Keuchel's out for the year. Or let's take somebody who's not, you know, Keuchel's probably pitching like a fifth starter right now this year. Let's say Dylan Cease, maybe somewhere in the middle. He somehow has gone for an extended period. They don't have anything to plug in. Kopech can't plug in there in a long-term role. They can't even do a crochet Kopech combination to ride that through. There is nothing in the minor leagues that can be reasonably expected to come in. And
that to me is the scariest part. Like this is one of the first years I can remember in recent history that they have absolutely nothing in the minors to rely on for pitching. Mm-hmm. So,
the funny thing is it's like right now, the Birmingham Barons rotation, which has been killer, is really like your Charlotte rotation, and they may play it that way. You may see a Connor Pilkington get a spot start maybe instead of Lambert again, or you know, depending on how everything falls, because those guys have been the horses, the Cade McClures, to some degree, even a Battenfield, you can imagine being a guy who just mops up a start one day somewhere in the future. And even Jason, I call him just Jason B because I really still don't know how to pronounce his last name. But I mean, he's made a fast move up the system, and a guy that people even think was a starter is now pitching well in the Birmingham rotation. So those are the guys, and you think one will come out of that, but not yet. I don't think they're going to jump from Double A and some of these guys at a very young age to be someone to plug in. And we heard this, Tommy, before the season even began. Oh, hey, who are the Yankees running out as a fourth or fifth starter? Tell me who, you know, blank team, you know, has at their third, fourth or fifth starter. And I get it. The White Sox are probably, especially given Carlos Rodon overperforming what we could expect, Dylan Cease overperforming what we could have expected. Even Dallas Keuchel, knowing that the expectations probably need to be tempered, he might not be undershooting what we would expect it too badly. But again, that's like saying, well, who could have anticipated 12 outfield injuries? You're supposed to at least have some card up your sleeve in every area. I'll even give Rick Hahn a pass that he shouldn't have a 12th outfielder ready to go. He could probably still make some kind of deal to get somebody in, but okay, he shouldn't have just had it in pocket before the season.
But that's the difference too, because, you know, I think the difference for the White Sox is that they've never been the organization to show any sign of audacity to make that move. And you're right. Like, you know, they're not the Yankees. They're not the Dodgers. They can't just go out and buy a free agent or buy a huge salary to plug a guy in a very limited role. But what the Rays do, what a lot of the small market teams do, is that they say, okay, let me weed through all of your 4A guys that aren't quite good enough on your major league roster, but we know fit a specific need that we're looking for as we make this playoff run. And that's what that's what you look for if you're not a team that's willing to spend the money. And the White Sox haven't shown that. And that's the part where you do kind of have to get a little into them about it, because, you know, scouting is great when you can do it in the off season, because you have the luxury of spring training to do extended evaluations on guys. So yes, it's awesome that, you know, Jake Lamb is apparently, you know, raking right now, and everybody loves Billy Hamilton, and that's awesome, and that makes me happy. But like, there's also the whole other side of it where it's like, you need guys for a playoff run, and you don't have the luxury of trotting them out every day in Arizona and watching them play and develop and see how they fit in and trying to make decisions based on that. And that's where the Sox haven't shown it yet. That doesn't mean they can't do it. They just haven't shown it.
It's great that these guys, like even Jake Lamb, seems like he's fulfilling whatever confidence was put in him in the role that he is supposed to play. But why are the names we're discussing Jake Lamb cut by whoever, Billy Hamilton cut early in spring by Cleveland? Yes. These are the guys we're talking about as sort of the crucial
dudes. Even Brian Goodwin, who hasn't made his way to the roster yet, got cut by the Pirates. I mean, you have to be in pretty bad shape to be cut by the Pirates.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And, you know, I get it that just because you've earmarked your five starters from around the league who you might feel are caught in between the 4A types of guys you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And you know, the White Sox better have that, of course. 5-10 guys. Hey, if they're in the waiver wire, we're grabbing them. And they did grab. They grabbed Emilio Vargas in the offseason. Way in the past, Rick Hahn, one of his, I think, first significant moves and one of the great ones we can give credit for, Jose Quintana.
The guy
that he snagged. So we know they can do it, but at some point you got to think, okay, was Jose Quintana just dumb luck? And when you haven't repeated this at all, very little, because you don't get credit for Carlos Rodon. It's great that he's finally being the guy you thought he was when you made him a high first round pick years ago.
Absolutely.
But at best, that's just, okay, you get your own credit. You now you have a first rounder fulfilling Cy Young run. This is amazing and wonderful. You know, credit restored, not new credit.
Right.
You know, the Whites, I can't think of the last time they've pulled off a move like that where it's like, wow, they took a guy off of the Pittsburgh scrap heap or the Tampa scrap heap, or made some weird deal that didn't seem like much at the time, but a year later, holy cow.
It blew up into something big, yeah.
And it does make you wonder if the Sox have it in them, and if it's almost like they want to spend like those small market teams, as mm-hmm. we've visited many times, probably already in the short life of the Believe in White Sox podcast, but then they want to have a chip or an arrogance like a big market team. Like, now we don't need to do any dumpster diving. We don't need to sift for any little tiniest pieces and grains of gold, because we're in Chicago. I don't know. We sort of got a nucleus. The window's open.
Yeah.
You got to scratch I know a lot of us, and you and I included, I think, have been sort of beating the drum of how crucial it is when we're in a contention window, those 20 through 26 positions on the roster. You don't want to think it's a big deal, because no, it's not as important as having your mashing first baseman or your ace pitcher. But man, those bench roles are huge. And the fact that we've got, I don't know if there's anyone beyond this, even in the lineup, is not inspiring. So certainly the bench and the minors is not inspiring. It's been great that we've been able to bring guys up like a Gavin Sheets, who's been doing very well. This isn't some sort of weird, there's been times where the Sox, certainly when they weren't in a window of contention, where they brought guys up because it's just like, well, it's his turn, or it's he's put guy. The most time in for Charlotte, so let's bring him up. It does seem to be certainly more merit-driven. The fact that you could have argued, geez, why not Jake Berger instead of Gavin Sheets? I mean, the fact that there's even that discussion is inspiring. You know, thank goodness. But on the pitching side, you wouldn't get that. Even on the relief side, it's been like, Zach Birdie, sure, he pitched last year. We don't want Ronaldo Lopez anywhere near this roster. So, Jimmy Lambert this time to take a starter or fill in as a guy. And it's sort of like this default thing. And that is not a contention window team. We're not talking about, this isn't the 12th injury. You know, in some of these areas, this is like they needed a spot guy to start a game and they didn't have anybody.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they're just like.
And we're only in June. I mean, like, it's just like we're not even that far into the season, and it's just, it's going to pile up. And, you know, that's why, even in terms of just getting a look and seeing how guys fit in on the roster, because I look at Adam Eaton and I'm just like, you know, I understand now what his supposed role is on this team. I don't agree with it, but I get what his purpose is, and that's fine. But he doesn't move all that well anyway. And you just watch every time he reaches up for a fly ball or every time he slides hard into second. I'm just like, those knees are not going to last forever. Get him some rest so that you can save him for the playoffs, which is when all of these intangibles that he offers are really going to come into play anyway.
See, Tommy, this is why you're my partner, because I don't even know what Adam Eaton's role is. So I need you to tell me. My guess would be it's to lecture guys when they swing on 3-0. Is that it? Or is there actually another role that he has, Tommy?
Well, if you're Kenny Williams, he offers the red ass that the White Sox needed so desperately and lost with AJ Pierzynski. And God knows that's why the White Sox didn't win between 2005 and 2000.
I was just going to say, it'd be simple. Let's just even say it's the last decade. Boy, the last decade could have been a lot easier. We could have just found a bunch of red ass guys.
Exactly.
And that's sort of his job. So why didn't he do that?
Right. And that is legitimate belief, is that there wasn't enough edge to the team and they needed somebody that could bring an edge.
Edge comes at a pretty premium price too. I didn't realize that the per war, the millions per grit grindy war was as
it adds up on the 10 million per
man.
Now you understand Bauer's contract.
Yeah. Oh my. Okay, we've talked about the current team. Now I'm going to hit you with a couple. Now it's a little bit of a free play in the podcast. And I want to know, we talked about our first White Sox games, I believe, last podcast. And that just went over like gangbusters, Tommy. I got to tell you, the listenership hit the root. And I think
they loved it.
Spiked during that time. So let's double down on that. Can you tell me, I didn't even give you this beforehand, so this is a tough one too, because I don't even know if I have the answer yet. So I'm going to make you answer first. What was a favorite? The favorite game you've ever been to?
Oh, okay. That one I do have an answer for.
Oh, good.
I have to look up the date of the game, but it was the White Sox against the Cardinals. It was when the Sox scored like 24 runs. It was like 24-6 or something insane like that. And of course, because Tony La Russa is in every story, it was against Tony La Russa. Mm-hmm. He got pissed off because he thought that the Sox were stealing signs when, as somebody that was at the game, all of the pitches were down the middle, like, and the wind was blowing out and it was a hot summer night. So, I mean, it was just home runs were everywhere. That was the biggest laugher that I'd ever been to, and it was a fun game.
Tommy, I was at that game too.
Oh yeah, okay.
Because that was 2006.
Yes,
it was. They killed them twice, two big routes,
two
and then
big
the
routes.
Last game was a sweep, and it was a one hitter. The White Sox won because the one hit was Jim Thome hitting a home run.
Hitting a home run, yeah.
And just think, Tommy, at that time, you much younger than I at the time, but at that time, we both went home thinking, this is a World Series team, and what is this clown team we just saw them destroy? And it turned out the clown team finished two games above 500 and won the World Series.
And we won
90 games and didn't even make the playoffs.
Yep.
I'm sort of glad we didn't know that then, because at the time I was like, man, this team is just
I thought they were completely poised for another run.
Yeah, it had something to do with Jason Marquis. I don't know if he started that game or the other route, but because they just beat hell out of him, I think. I mean, now I might be getting Cubs routes and Cardinals routes mixed up, but that sticks in my head somehow. In addition to chiding Albert Pujols for some reason, just because he was good, so you had to like yell at him and
say
like steroids or whatever. But you know, I was younger then. Yes. Well, how about that? We were both at your favorite game. Where were you sitting? I was down the left field line.
I was in the left field bleachers.
Boy, I tell you, we could. Yeah. We could have. Maybe
exactly.
We both were. We did an air high five.
Exactly. Yeah.
there are a lot of games that I would call favorites, of course. I was lucky, very, very fortunate enough to see all of the playoff run in 2005 in some really nice seats, criticize the White Sox and even my buddy Scott Reiford often, but Scott came through for me there and connected me and my dad with some unbelievable tickets for that right near Nancy Faust. So that's pretty sweet.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it's hard not to pick a 2005 game, but I will say a game with my wife, a spontaneous game, the blackout game.
Oh,
that
nice. I almost went to that game.
Okay.
And I, cause I got, my friend got tickets for it and said that they were like, hey, I'll buy an extra ticket for you. Completely ditched me. And
into a not favorite game.
I was like, I was scrambling to try to get tickets for it because I had to go. So I ended up going to a friend's place and we had like a huge blackout party to, you know, watch the game and everything. But I can only imagine what the energy was like at that game.
Yeah, that was so, obviously the blackout, that was such a different, such a different vibe. You're not used to necessarily, even coming off of the 2005, 2006 season where you're used to seeing full ballpark. You know, the 2005 playoff run had those goofy thunder sticks and there's some other thing that was way, I don't know, Homer Hanky, some nonsense. The fact that they came up with this cool idea and came up with it so spontaneously, I think they were literally just, they were just like black towels. There was no branding. It was just somebody went to Bed Bath
& Beyond. Here's the towel. Yeah.
Like stole out the bed, you know, like knocked over a semi truck and said, we're just taking these.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they left like a $10,000 bill, you know, on
exactly.
the counter and said, we're going to hand these out at the game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, obviously the nature of the game, the home run, John Danks, and just stirring pitching performance, the throw out, one great memory of Ken Griffey as a White Sox player throwing out. And
when he wasn't napping, you know,
and A.J. Pierzynski, so brassy, not just taking the hit from, I think, it was Michael Kadire, but then
showing him the ball. Yep.
I love that rascal. My wife calls him the Campbell Soup Kid because I guess he sort of looks like a Campbell Soup Kid. But boy, he's a Campbell Soup Kid. You don't want to turn your back on because he'll punch you in the back of the head.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the one that maybe comes to mind for me, you know, among many, and I'm sure you have many as well. It's funny that you came up with a game because just on Southside Sox, again, where we write, so we're going to bring it up often. That game's come up just recently, and I forget even the context of it, but that's been up in the comments, and people were identifying the weird one-hitter game to finish up that series. And then the fact that the first two games, I don't know, it was like a combined like 30 to 10. It was just a ridiculous runaway.
It was really insane how, because I think at that point in time, I mean, the Sox were just winning series right and left and just all routes. And they just steamrolled St. Louis in those games.
Every time a Chicago team like wins a title, makes a push, and I guess you can't really count the Bulls in that because they had such a nucleus, you knew you could count on it. But the Blackhawks, I'd say, and any winning White Sox team, and I assume this even extends to the Bears, though I don't really pay attention to the Bears any longer. Every year, the next year, you think, okay, was that?
Is that real?
The team, you know, you always have this one, okay, is Joe Creedy, is he beginning a Hall of Fame career or is this his one season? You know, are these, is this all made up of career years? And at that point in 2006, it was enough to think, oh, wait, hold on. Jose Contreras is never going to lose again.
Yeah.
Joe Creedy is beginning a Hall of Fame career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as it turns out, we know now, you know, a lot of those things ended up happening, but at that time it was still like, you know what, this isn't a one hit wonder. This isn't even like 85 Bears, which was by no means a one hit wonder, but sort of in the record book turns out to be. And, you know, you could believe, you could go home from that game. Again, me and you, Tommy, went home and said, man, they're going to the World. You're like thinking, how do I get World Series tickets? And I'm thinking, man, I wonder if I can, you know, use some contacts to get some great tickets again. Because, man, that was sweet, even though it's going to be boring by now. It'll be the second World Series run. But, yeah, a lot of things changed. Man,
things
what a year.
Come at you fast, right?
What a year. God, 90 wins. Oh, my God, what a year. Okay, my other question was, because we're music guys, I know you are, and I'm a late bloomer on this question, but this is an easy answer. It's not going to be a hard one for you, but As I guess we're winding up this record-breaking Believe Network podcast. Who knew a record-breaking podcast would be the Chicago White Sox podcast? But I'm here to tell you, listeners, all of you out there, and I can't even necessarily count each one of you individually, but close. It's true. I would not lie to you on the Believe in White Sox podcast. The question is, first concert.
First concert. Oh, wow. All right. This one's probably going to surprise you. The first concert that I went to, and I kid you not, was a Puff Daddy and Family concert at the Allstate Arena. And it was, of course, because I was excited to go because I wanted to see Notorious B.I.G., but it was shortly after he was killed. But I did get to see Busta Rhymes, Lil' Kim. Like, you know, looking back on it now, it's like a who's who of basically everybody that was like in that Puff Daddy entourage. And I had no concept of like how big that was at the time, because, you know, back then it was just kind of pop music and nobody really paid that much attention to it. But I've talked to friends about it, like looking back on it, and they're like, oh my gosh, everybody was in this concert. How did, like, how cool is that? I was like, yeah, I didn't really realize that at the time, but in retrospect, yeah, it was very cool. But that was my first concert. It was a absolute mess, as you would probably expect it to be. And I was there with my dad. So hi, Dad. And yeah, my dad has always been, he is, he, you know, at, all at the same time, he's a hard ass, but at the same time, he loves like just seeing different music experiences and figuring out like what's out there. Even though he'll just go be, and be like, yeah, that's not real music. Right. I'm going to go listen to, you know, Miles Davis now.
He's got his headphones on.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, we've always gone to concerts together because it's just, it's always been like, I think a really interesting experience for him just to see just how much in some ways things have changed, but then in other ways, like things are very much the same. So if you go to a, you know, Dave Matthews Band concert, it's just basically like, you know, probably like what a Fish or Grateful Dead concert is like, where it's just a communal experience, and he thinks that that's just the coolest thing ever. But yeah, that was my first show.
That is pretty terrific, because I, you know, my dad has got half of that. He's got the hard ass, the openness. No, so that's pretty cool that he can say, like, you know, this isn't my thing, but
yeah,
all right, you know. And now, was that an age where you needed to be accompanied, or should have been, or it's plausible?
Should have been, yeah.
So I mean, that helps too, I guess. Where he's like, well, he really wants to go to the show, and you know, I'll go along with him. And I have apparently set up a bit of a precedent.
Yeah, I mean, this was a thing that went on. So like, even in my college years, like going to Lollapalooza, like he wanted to go. So like we'd be, then this is like the Grant Park Lollapalooza years. So, you know, he's down there, like, you know, we're hanging out listening to Daft Punk. So, I mean, like, it's just,
this is what he did. You know, you're listening because you're one of the throngs who are listening to the Believe in White Sox podcast, but, man, that's really odd. Because I was just going to say, this very first one sounds pretty much like a Lollapalooza experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it probably had to go on. You know, I'm imagining maybe it's not quite necessarily like full sets, but there's still a lot of people to get through. So that concert itself probably had to stretch for a little bit for a first show.
It was about 2.5-3 hours. Yeah.
That's bold.
That's, yeah.
So Allstate Arena is your first show.
Makes sense.
A lot of people, you know, arena shows would be their first show.
Yeah. And of course, it was called the Rosemont back then, but yeah.
Dating yourself, Tommy.
I know.
You're older than we all think. Your sweet, sort of high voice is really throwing everybody off, you know. Well, I went to, and I was sort of, so what age were you for this first concert then?
13, 12, oh, somewhere around there.
Yeah, see, okay, this then proves what a loser I am, because my first concert was, I was 18. I was 18, Tommy. Right before I went off to college, I went up with high school buddies a couple of weeks before I went off to college to Alpine Valley.
Nice. To see
Boston.
All right.
And, you know, got my concert t-shirt, got my little three-quarter cut concert t-shirt.
There you go.
Third stage tour, Tommy. I'm not so old that I was seeing them, you know, late 70s, but yeah, you know, it's was a show that, you know, touched enough, you know, I mean, that's a pretty safe show, I guess.
Oh yeah.
And I want to say the first one should have been U2 earlier that spring, but my dad, who again has the hard ass part down, but some of the other parts not, barred me from it because I don't know, I did some kind of mischief and that was my punishment. I couldn't go to the show I was supposed to go. Oh yeah. And I remember even telling him, Tommy, like, I'm never gonna forget this. You're gonna pay, you know.
Yeah, a
little dramatic.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, so you know, I made up the lost time. That's kind of
rough.
Yeah, that's rough.
I mean, you know, that's a pretty huge, you know, gap between you two and Boston. But Alpine Valley is a nice concert venue, so you had that.
Yeah, you know, the whole adventure. You know.
Yeah.
I was. I guess I was probably pretty innocent. So yeah, it was a nice adventure. And, you know, I made up for lost time. I did, you know, I don't know if I've out pulled the Tommy Barbie list of shows, but I was very aggressive. My wife will tell you, I was very aggressive in seeing shows. And, but yeah, started real late and real, and yeah, sort of funny, but I figure that in most people's cases, I was expecting something much funnier coming from you, especially at age 12 or 13. Time after,
you know, yeah,
some crazy, like just really one-off pop thing or something, because that's usually what people's, you know, experiences are.
It's
like you went with your parents to see, I don't know, Glenn Campbell or, you know, you went to see, I don't know what the more modern equivalents would be, but, saw Tiffany at a shopping mall or something, but I'm a little closer to Tiffany in the shopping mall with my Boston experience. My
there you go,
three quarter yeah. cut concert t-shirt. I was rocking. But yeah, not with my dad.
No.
I did see one concert with my dad. As long as we're just going to make this an extended segment, I saw one for his 50th birthday. I bought him tickets and invited him down. I was still down at school. In Fort Worth and Dallas, and Neil Diamond. He loves nice. Neil Diamond, so I decided to take my dad to Neil Diamond, which I don't have to tell you, don't really care for.
Right,
you know, yeah. It's his birthday.
Yeah.
And boy, he had a good time. He
That's
kept
good.
Punching me, not in an angry way, but like, man, this is great. Oh my God,
yeah,
this is so
exactly.
great.
Yeah.
So yes, that's the only time we ever saw a concert together. So that's a really cool experience. I doubt that that's real common. Maybe it's more common than I think, but that's pretty neat that you and your dad can maybe even still do that. Or
yeah,
eventually.
Yeah.
Eventually,
you know, when there's not a pandemic. That, yeah. But right. No, I mean, it's always, I think it's just a fun experience because it's, you know, I did something similar for my dad because I took him to see, it was Kings of Leon and Bob Dylan. And I took him to see Bob Dylan for his birthday. And he just was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I had no idea he was even in Chicago. And I was like, yeah, here.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. We're here. Yeah. I wasn't snowing yet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really happening. All right. Well, we'll come up with some other interesting music discussion in the next. I know nobody can wait. And I know you want it to
know.
Be like tomorrow, everybody, but it's okay. We got to play at least a series before we talk again. Maybe
exactly.
We'll check back in before Toronto. I know there are a couple of days off packed in the next week. So chances are we probably will sit down and talk, whether it's pre-Toronto series or post. We'll talk again. And of course, the overwhelming numbers and the plaudits that are going to be coming in for this Believe in White Sox podcast probably will force us, Tommy, to talk before the Toronto series. So we probably will be visiting with all of you before the next series begins.
I kind of have a feeling that the throngs of people may force us to, you know, push up the date a little bit.
Right. So. Maybe there'll be a Canadian theme to it, even though the Toronto's not playing in Toronto this year. Maybe
that's
it'll be
true.
Canadian theme. But we'll think on some stuff because we got to touch on movies too. We know that even though I'm again just sort of ignorant and dumb about this stuff, Tommy Barbie, my partner here, a cinephile, musicologist, and you know, hey. Baseball expert as well. He knows he's the Adam Eaton whisperer. So That's why I was smart enough to tag
Kenny Williams, you know, that's my pipeline.
Ken, how you doing? Let's talk soon. Okay. Thanks everybody for listening. We have a lot of fun doing this, and we know that we have, you guys all have a lot of fun listening. Of course, feel free to send us a message and let us know types of things you want to hear. Probably more from Tommy. So just, you can direct it to him. It's fine. I won't be offended, but you know, any feedback you have, we are, we're up to here, but you know, otherwise you just figure you're loving it. Loving the White Sox season, of course, that is indisputable. But hopefully you're also loving our Believe in White Sox podcast. We will keep churning them out for you as you continue to grow in listenership and demand more and more of the delightful Tommy Barbie and his partner, some guy named Brett. That's me. And thank you for listening. Tommy, thanks for joining me again. And let's do this again maybe in just a few days.
Sounds good. Take care, everyone.